From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. From its earliest days, almost nothing has come easy for the people of Baltimore. That's one conclusion to draw from the 600-page political history of the city by Matthew Crenson, professor emeritus of political science at Johns Hopkins.
It goes all the way back to when they got their town charter in 1729. They weren't allowed to elect the town commissioners, and the town commissioners had no power. They labored under the shadow of Annapolis for centuries. And they always seemed to be a little bit behind other cities.
Crenson paints a picture of a disjointed power structure. And even though before the Civil War, Baltimore was home to America's largest concentration of free blacks, a tendency to ignore issues of slavery and race. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. For anyone who cares about Baltimore and how it got to be the way it is, Matthew Crenson's political history of the city is fascinating and necessary reading. Crenson is professor emeritus of political science at Johns Hopkins University. He writes that he's been collecting information for this political history for nearly five decades. When having grown up in Baltimore, he'd moved to Chicago at age 20 and found himself missing the quirks of Charm City, dreaming about its intersections. After some research, Crenson understood he was missing the particularity of Baltimore politics. Matthew Crenson, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You write that when you were growing up in the 50s, Baltimore had an inferiority complex, and now, you say, Baltimoreans are proud of their inferiority complex. What does that mean?
Well, Baltimoreans had an inferiority complex for a very long time. It goes all the way back to when they got their town charter in 1729. They weren't allowed to elect the town commissioners, and the town commissioners had no power. They labored under the shadow of Annapolis for centuries. And they always seemed to be a little bit behind other cities. For example, they were not a site of original colonization. Baltimore didn't come along until almost 100 years after the first British settlers arrived in Maryland. And so they were a catch-up city with less history than other East Coast cities, less money, less ancestors, less fame. And I think they developed a kind of modesty about themselves at a very early date.
And that's changed?
Not much.
Well, let's go back to those early years, your early chapters. Tell us a lot about Maryland history because, as you say, the town was very much a creature of the province. The province of Maryland tried to start several towns.
They did.
The settlement on the Patapsco was nothing special.
Nothing special. And in fact, few of the other towns came to much. Many of them were just tobacco inspection stations that had only a seasonal existence. Baltimore was one of the first real towns to emerge after, I guess, Joppa and Annapolis. And in 1729, it had a population supposed to be about 43, although the number is not exact. And they applied for a town charter. They got one, as I've just explained. It gave the town commissioners the power to purchase 60 acres of land from the Carroll family, have it surveyed into 60 lots with appropriate provision made for streets, lanes, and alleys, and then they were to sell the lots for 40 shillings apiece. That was the extent of their power. So they had no ability to deal with the kinds of problems that arise when a bunch of people, even just 43 people, have to live in close proximity to one another.
And one of the problems that you detail is swine.
Swine. Pig,
wandering.
Pigs and livestock, yes. They wandered the streets of the town, and the streets were not paved, so they very quickly turned sloppy and odoriferous. The town commissioners had no authority to do anything about this, and so with other Baltimoreans, they went to Annapolis and petitioned the provincial assembly to enact a statute that would require the residents of Baltimore to keep their livestock, especially their pigs, in pens. Nobody bothered to anticipate how this law was going to be enforced. There was no staff for this town commissioners. They all had day jobs. They didn't have time to go chasing pigs through the streets. And so nothing changed. Until finally, in 1747, the Provincial Assembly gave them the power to regulate public nuisances and also to hire a clerk. Since the plan to keep the pigs fenced in had not worked, they decided to keep them fenced out. And so they built a wooden fence around the entire perimeter of Baltimore town.
The 60 lots.
The 60 lots. Also, by this time, they had annexed Jonestown. That was another wooden fence around the original Jonestown, what we now call Old Town. Things worked fine. Pigs were supposed to stay outside, and they did, until the weather turned cold. And then Baltimoreans, apparently many Baltimoreans, began to steal the fence posts for firewood. The commissioners were irate. They directed their clerk to conduct an investigation to find out who the guilty parties were. He found many, including the rector of St. Paul's Church and the town physician, who also happened to be its most successful merchant. The commissioners decided that they would punish these culprits by suing them for damages. But then they discovered that the charter that they'd received from the Provincial Assembly did not designate them a body politic and corporate, which meant that they had no standing in law, so they couldn't sue anybody. And so they just gave up, abandoned the fence, and pigs continued to wander the streets of Baltimore for more than 100 years thereafter.
Is this emblematic of the entire operation of town government during those early decades?
I think it probably is. There was one problem after another. There were problems with trash, with sewage, very sort of unpleasant kinds of problems, things that made it difficult for people to live in Baltimore, positively unpleasant in some cases.
That's political scientist and historian Matthew Crenson here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're discussing Baltimore, a political history. One of the continuing themes of your political history of Baltimore is transportation and specifically the railroad. Mm-hmm. You describe it as a, quote, venture in state capitalism, mm-hmm. end quote. How did that project start?
Well, Baltimore's chief asset was, or had been, its geographic location. It was further west than any other port city on the eastern seaboard, which put it in an ideal location to link up the agricultural produce of the interior at a time when people were moving inland, moving west, and the Atlantic trade. That advantage was undermined by the completion of the Erie Canal, and later, to a lesser extent, by the completion of the C&O Canal. Baltimore's merchants became desperate. They saw themselves sinking back into poverty. And so they began to look for solutions. First, they looked at canals. They tried a few canal projects that didn't work very well. Then they seized on a brand new technology, the railroad. There was no interstate railroad in the United States at the time, no railroad that carried passengers. But the B&O Railroad, started by a local committee, was one of the most popular business enterprises in the history of the city, or the state. Maryland and Baltimore City together bought half of all the initially issued stock in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The residents of Baltimore bought up the rest. 20% of Baltimore's population owned stock in the B&O. So many people wanted to buy it that it had to be doled out in fractional shares. But there was a problem here. The railroad technology was new. Nobody was sure how different things would work. It was also a problem of organization. This was an interstate corporation. It required organizational arrangements that had never been tried before. And so the result was that the costs of this enterprise were very difficult to predict. For example, nobody knew exactly what railroad tracks should look like. At first, it was just an iron strip on top of a wooden stringer. That was fine as long as the cars were pulled by horses. But when they switched to heavy steam locomotives, the ends of these iron straps tended to curl upward in something called snakeheads. They were dangerous because they could derail an engine, obviously. Even worse, they could erupt through the floor of a passenger car and whip around, maiming and killing the occupants. So they had to come up with a new kind of railroad track, which cost a lot more to make. It had to be solid iron. As these costs piled up, the B&O made more and more demands for money from Baltimore City. $3 million here, $5 million there. That was a lot of money in those days.
And these demands were in the form of loans?
Loans. And in order to make the loans, Baltimore had to borrow money itself. So much money that by 1840, the single largest item, the biggest item in this municipal budget, was interest payments. It had absorbed so much of the city's money that it could no longer afford effective law enforcement. In the 1840s, for example, Baltimore's population was over 100,000. It could afford only 26 officers, night watchmen, to protect Baltimoreans at night, 26 police officers, in effect, to protect over 100,000 people. Later in the decade of the 1840s, when the population of the city was approaching 150,000, 160,000, the city could afford only 2,500 seats in its public school system. Neighborhoods were demanding the construction of public schools. Baltimore couldn't afford them. So in much the same way that the state had sort of blighted the development of Baltimore, the B&O and its cost also inhibited the development of Baltimore and its public services. Another way to develop a local inferiority complex.
Fast forward to near the end of the 19th century, the Baltimore and Ohio goes into bankruptcy.
They had been paying dividends for a while, but they had this overhanging load of debt incurred under construction. So around 1895, President B&O approached the city and said, look, we have this $5 million debt we owe you. It's supposed to be paid off. It's a 50-year debt. It's supposed to be paid off in 1895. We can't afford to do that. Why don't you give us another 50 years and lower the interest rate from 6% to 4.5%? The implicit message was, if you don't do this, since Baltimore is now the biggest stockholder in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, what's going to happen to the value of the rest of your stock? But Baltimoreans finally bit the bullet, and the city of Baltimore demanded its $5 million on schedule. They received it. The B&O had already stopped paying dividends. And the next year, 1896, they went bankrupt and were no longer controlled by Baltimore interests.
Another recurring saga in your history starts with stench.
Oh, yes.
On page 287, in a section you've labeled the city aromatic, you talk about a large mass of putrid, pestilential matter. What was the problem?
Baltimore had no sanitary sewer system. In fact, it was one of the last major cities in the country to have one. That happened for a variety of reasons. For one thing, it was politically convenient. The members of the Baltimore City Council, under law, had the right to issue permits to their constituents to drain their sewage directly into the inner harbor. So these were favors that you could do for the voters and were part of the politicians' operating capital. They also, about 15,000 to 20,000 businesses and homes, drained sewage into the Jones Falls, which of course flowed into the harbor. The limitations on municipal power, municipal authority in Baltimore, imposed largely by the state, made it very difficult to develop a kind of coherent and centralized power that would make it possible to develop a citywide project like a sewer system. So the city responded in a disjointed way to lots of neighborhood crises. They would put in a little sewer here, a little sewer there, a drainage ditch here. There was no comprehensive plan. There was another problem. Baltimoreans relied on privies. The privies had to be cleaned out. That was the job of the so-called night soil men, who would travel through the city with their wagons, barrels, and buckets and clean out privies. The consequences for the aroma of the city were quite pronounced. And along about the 1870s, a company came along with a solution for that problem. It was called the Odorless Apparatus Excavating Company that would pump out privies. A small charcoal furnace would be placed on top of the tank. A little valve would be open. That would burn off the odors that came with the pumping out. And they immediately won the business of many city agencies. The school system, for example, immediately became a customer. And the odorless excavating apparatus interest group became a political obstacle to the construction of a sewer system, because if there were a sewer system, they would no longer be needed.
We need to take a quick break here on the record with Matthew Krenson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. His book is Baltimore, A Political History. When we're back, we'll look at some of the racial history of the city. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast with political scientist Matthew Krenson, talking about his book, Baltimore, A Political History. You give us a good grounding in race relations at different points in Baltimore's history. And at one point, early in the 19th century, you're describing a situation and you write, quote, "Conflict avoidance has been an enduring motif in Baltimore's engagement with slavery and race," end quote. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, Baltimore, by and large, has tried to deal with the race issue by not talking about it in public. In private, they talk about it all the time with one another, but not as a public or political issue. This was evident very early in the city's history. For example, in 1787, a Maryland Abolition Society was formed. It went out of business around 1800. And its leadership was almost all Baltimoreans. An attempt was made to revive it in 1807. But some of the city's leading abolitionists, Quakers mostly, refused to go along. Instead, they organized in 1816 a protection society. Its purpose was to prevent free black people from falling into the hands of slavers. In other words, it wasn't a direct challenge to slavery itself. It was just to preserve the freedom of black people already free. And Baltimore, by that time, had the largest concentration of free black people in the United States. But it continued to avoid the race issue. For example, in 1838, an English traveler, James Silk Buckingham, retired member of the House of Commons, was making a year-long tour of the United States. He visited Baltimore for 4 to 6 weeks, then wrote a book about his travels in which he said he heard less talk about slavery in Baltimore than any other city he'd visited. And when the issue did come up, he said, there was very tolerance for a variety of views. In other words, it was discussed very seldom. And when there were discussions, they tended to be very subdued.
Why do you think that was?
There may be several reasons why this happened. For one thing, Baltimore was a border city. And so it might be expected to have divided opinions about issues of race and slavery. But I looked at other border towns like St. Louis and Lexington, Kentucky. They didn't behave in the same way. They were on the front lines of the anti-slavery, pro-slavery battle. I think the critical thing in Baltimore was that Baltimore had a large population of Quakers, many of which had emigrated here from Philadelphia. And there were many included in Baltimore's merchant elite, Moses Shepard, the Ellicotts of Ellicott City, Johns Hopkins, the Pulteney family. So on the one hand, you had abolitionist Quakers in the city's elite. On the other hand, you had people from the Eastern Shore, Southern Maryland, and points further south who took slavery for granted. They had to live together. They socialized together. Perhaps most important, they did business with one another. And so there's one issue that they didn't talk about much in public because it would disturb domestic tranquility.
How did that play out?
They continued to avoid the issue right up until the eve of the Civil War. Right after Abraham Lincoln was elected, a new mayor was inaugurated in Baltimore. And in his inaugural address, George William Brown said, national affairs have nothing to do with municipal administration, and so we're just not going to pay attention to these things. And many Baltimoreans seem to agree it was an issue that they didn't want to talk about. And it's continued long after the Civil War. I experienced it myself.
How so?
When I was 11, it was 1954, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, the famous school desegregation case. I heard about it on my father's car radio. I remember thinking, well, that's it. The schools are going to be desegregated across the board. I was about to go from a legally segregated all-white elementary school in Govins to what would be a junior high school. What I didn't know was that the court had decided to hold the Brown case over for a year to hear argument about how its decision would be implemented. And so nobody was under any legal compulsion to desegregate their schools. Nevertheless, just 17 days after the Brown decision, the Baltimore City Board of School Commissioners voted unanimously and with no public discussion to desegregate the schools under a freedom of choice plan, beginning with the next academic year. So in September, I would be attending a moderately desegregated junior high school named after Robert E. Lee. And I didn't really think about it until much later. Although this was a significant change in our lives. It was the first time that African-American and white school children had gone to school together with one another. Nobody at Robert E. Lee ever said anything to us about what was happening or why or how we should react to it or what was the reason for it. And yet later when I was doing research for my book, I found a report that had been done a couple of years later. It said, first of all, that the school superintendent and the school board thought that the less said in advance about school integration, the better, because talking about it would imply that there were problems. And so they executed this preemptive strike with no public discussion to try to cut off debate and discussion about school desegregation. They also sent a memo around to all the schools in the system telling the teachers and the staff just to go about business as usual as though nothing were happening so nobody would get disturbed or distressed. In other words, silence was the school system's policy for dealing with race.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with political scientist Matthew Crenson about his new book, Baltimore, A Political History. You make, I think, a similar point that Baltimore elevated its first black mayor and elected its second black mayor with not much discussion.
Hardly any.
About race in their campaigns.
In every other city, the election of black mayor has been a cause for great conflict and controversy. I remember when Harold Washington was elected in Chicago in 1983. But here we just seem to slide into it. William Donald Schaefer, who had been mayor, became governor. His position was taken under the city charter by Clarence Du Burns, an African-American who had made a career by sort of cooperating with white political party figures in Baltimore. Actually, he had worked for a long time for one of the white Democratic clubs. And in the election the next year, 1987, there were two major candidates. There was had been a third. Robert Embry, now the director of the Able Foundation, had thought about running for mayor and decided not to because he didn't want to make race a political issue. He thought it would make for an ugly election. And so he decided to stand down. As a result, the two major candidates for mayor, Kirk Schmoke and Clarence Du Burns, were both African Americans. Race wasn't an issue.
As a political scientist, as you look at this, has this been a strength or a weakness for Baltimore?
It's helped us to avoid a lot of the strife that occurred in other cities. I spent 4 years in Chicago and watched how the city sort of tore itself apart. On the other hand, there are a lot of things that we should have been talking about all along, that we should have been cooperating about, that we've overlooked. The result is that a large part of the city's white population no longer lives in the city. People who should have been participants in our collective deliberations about race are no longer here to be part of the conversation. We might have been able to address some of the city's problems more effectively if, and to allow its citizens to achieve a higher degree of equality, if we'd actually talked about this issue a lot more, if we could have combined our relative peacefulness with a more openness on the issue of race, I think we'd probably be a lot better off today.
Matthew Crinson, there's so much more I wish I could ask you about. Congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Crinson is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. We spoke when Baltimore, A Political History was published last August. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.